how we write the superpositions in quantum mechanics, with these angle brackets indicating that it's a quantum state. And the thing is that if you were to look at this state to say, well, what is it? Is it a 0 or a 1? You will get an answer. You'll get the answer 0 with probability a squared, or absolute value a squared, a and b could be complex, and 1 with probability absolute value b squared. So the quantum state, even though, like I said, it in some sense is in two states at once, it's both 0 and 1, in another sense, when you look at it, it has to decide, is it 0 or is it 1? So in that sense, it's one or the other. Okay, and then if you have these superpositions, these qubits, you can do things to them, just as you could do things to the bits in a regular classical computer. For instance, you could flip a bit, right? 0 would become 1, 1 would become 0. And then if you do that on a superposition, a0 plus b1, well, the 0 becomes 1 and the 1 becomes 0. So you have a1 plus b0. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. You can also interact two qubits in the same ways that you could interact classical bits. So for instance, two bits, if you have two bits, there's four possible states, right? 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And so the general quantum state, the general state of two qubits, is a0, 0, plus b0, 1, plus c1, 0, plus d1, 1. And actually, these a, b, and c, and d are not completely arbitrary because, well, when you look at them, you have to get some answer, right? The probabilities have to add up to 1. And so a squared plus b squared plus c squared plus d squared has to equal 1. But other than that, they can be anything. And then you could do, for instance, what's called the controlled NOT gate. What the controlled NOT gate is, it takes the first qubit and says, well, if it's 0, I'm going to do nothing to the second qubit. And if the first qubit is 1, I'm going to flip the second qubit. Okay? So let's see what that does to the superposition. Well, we have a0, 0 plus b0, 1 plus c1, 0 plus d1, 1. So 0, 0, the first bit is 0, so the second bit stays the same. We still get a0, 0. 0, 1, again, the first bit is 0, so we get b0, 1 here. But c1, 0, the first bit is 1, so we flip the second qubit, and it becomes plus c1, 1. And similarly, the last term, 1, 1 becomes 1, 0. So we have this quantum superposition as the final state of this gate. Okay? So doing individual quantum interactions like this, quantum gates they're called, you could do any computation that you could do on a classical computer. And you can do it on superpositions. So you could create a superposition of states, do this computation, and then measure to see what the answer is. The problem is there's not really much point in doing that, right? Because when you measure, you just get one of the results at random. And you know, you could have done that on a classical computer. You could have just flipped a coin or a couple of coins to say which of many possible starting states we wanted to use, and then done the computation on that. And that would get you the same thing, right? It would just randomly get you one of these many, many computations that you could have done. So in order to really use quantum computers, to let them do something that you can't do classically, you have to have some way of having the different terms in these superpositions talk to each other, to interact with each other. And to do that, we're going to need to use the phenomenon of interference. Okay, so to make interference, we have to think about how we create and destroy superpositions from the regular classical states that we're starting with. So in this case, we have we could start with either 0 or 1. So let's just start with the regular values of the classical bit. And we want to do some operation. We'll call it a Hadamard transform. That's just what we call it. It's named after a person. That will create a superposition out of these states. So for instance, it'll take 0 to 0 plus 1. And because we have to have the probabilities add up to 1, remember, or the square of the probabilities, it's 0 over square root of 2 and 1 over square root of 2. And so I've just taken that outside the parentheses here. And then 1, well, it has to go to a different state. So in this case, it's going to go to 0 minus 1 over square root of 2. OK? And so the minus sign is going to be very important in a moment. And that's going to be what makes the interference actually work. OK, so now let's imagine we did this Hadamard transform on a qubit that was already in a superposition. So we had 0 plus 1 over root 2, say. We do this Hadamard transform. Well, what happens to it? Well, the 0, we know that what that does, that goes to 0 plus 1 over root 2. Right? And it was divided by root 2. So we have 2 root 2, so it's 1 half 0 plus 1. Then we have to add the thing that happens to 1. What happens to 1? It goes to 0 minus 1 over root 2. And again, there's another root 2 down here. So we get a 1 half. Then we have 0 minus 1. So we have 0 plus 1 over 2 plus 0 minus 1 over 2. The zeros add up. We get 0. The ones, we have a plus and a minus, so they cancel. So the final state, we do this Hadamard transform on the superposition 0 plus 1. We get just back 0 again. Okay? Just a single basis state, it's called, one of these classical bit strings. In this case, a single bit. Okay? So this is, so you see both constructive and destructive interference going on here, right? Constructive interference, because the zeros add up to make, you add half 0 and half 0, and that add up to a full size 0. Whereas the ones, they cancel. You have a plus 1 and a minus 1. And so that's destructive interference. And by cleverly taking advantage of constructive and destructive interference, we can get the different, if we could make a superposition, do a whole bunch of different computations, and get them to interfere with each other. And doing that, we can get information about kind of the whole class of computations that we couldn't get just using a classical computer to randomly pick one or a couple of those possible computations. Okay? Are there any questions on this part? No? Really? Okay, well, you'll have a chance later. Okay. So I've said we can do things with a quantum computer that you can't do with a classical computer. So what kinds of things can you do? Well, so one of the most famous examples of an application of a quantum computer is used to factor large numbers. Okay, so if you have, you know, two prime numbers, say, you know, 150 digits long, well, multiplying the other is relatively easy. Well, I mean, you know, it would take a long time by hand, but certainly your computer could do it just like that. Okay? But going the other way, if you have a 300-digit number that you happen to know is a product of two big primes, figuring out what those two primes are, that could take a really long time. Right? I mean, certainly you know how to do it, right? You could say, well, does this number divisible by 2? Is it divisible by 3? Is it divisible by 5? Try all the primes. But if it's a 300-digit number, there's an awful lot of primes you have to try. So as it happens, people have figured out ways that are much, much better than trying all possible primes. But they still take a ridiculously long time. So long that, you know, factoring a 300-digit number would probably take billions of years. Whereas, again, multiplying two 250-digit numbers together to get a 300-digit number, that would take, you know, a fraction of a second. This is actually very practically important because it turns out that one of the most widely used cryptographic systems called RSA, I'll tell you about it in a minute, depends for its security on factoring being very hard. If you could factor large numbers, then you could break RSA, and that would have a big practical impact. So like I said, I'll say more about the factoring algorithm in a minute. But before I do that, let me just mention a couple of other things that quantum computers can do. So one thing, which is another real big advantage of quantum computers, is they can simulate other quantum systems, right? Because if you have a quantum system, you know, a bunch of individual atoms interacting, say like a chemical reaction, or you know, a high temperature superconductor, something like that. Well, the laws of quantum mechanics are important for the behavior of these systems, and the state they can be in is a superposition state. And so if you wanted to keep track of this on a classical computer, you'd have to take all the possible branches of superposition into account. And that would be a huge computation, something that, well, for very small quantum systems we can do. But as they get larger, quickly becomes impossible. Again, you know, billions of years territory. But a quantum computer, well, a quantum computer naturally does the superpositions. So a quantum computer is really good at simulating the behavior of other quantum systems. And while this is not something that probably most people would want to do at home, it is really important for physicists and for chemists and for anyone who has to deal with the behavior of individual atoms. And once you can simulate those, you can get a better understanding of how many of these systems work, and maybe that could have lots of important results come out of that. Okay, so those are two examples where you get a really, really, really big speed up from quantum mechanics. Things that take a ridiculously long time on a classical computer take almost, well, not almost no time, but take very little time on a quantum computer. But quantum computers can get speed ups for a bunch of other problems that aren't quite as large, but can still be really important. So for instance, if you have a really long list of things that you want to try, you know, perhaps you've heard of the traveling salesman problem. You have different possible solutions to the traveling salesman problem. You don't know which one is right. You try all of them. Okay? So if you have this long list of n things, well, classically, you'd kind of have to try them all one after another until you find one that works. But quantum mechanically, well, you can kind of try them all at once. But again, you have to take advantage of superposition. You don't immediately get the answer, the one that works, because when you measure, you'll just get one at random. Might not be the right one. But what you can do is you can do multiple rounds of interference and get these things to add up, so you only have to try about the square root of n things before you find the right one, the one that works. And, well, when n is small, this is not such a big advantage. When n is really big, you know, a billion or a trillion or something like that, this starts to really become a big advantage. And so a quantum computer can help speed up these types of really long searches. So another very recent algorithm discovered last spring can similarly find a square root speed up if you want to take an exhaustive search of a game tree. Like, for instance, in chess, if you want to figure out the optimal sequence of moves, you say, well, okay, so if I do this, and my opponent does this, and I do that, and my opponent does that, who wins? And you might imagine you have to go through every possible game to figure out the best possible move. Right? And there's a ridiculously large amount of games, so you couldn't actually do that. But a quantum computer, well, you still can't do it on a quantum computer. It's still too big. But, you know, it's only a square root number of things you'd have to try. So real chess computers do, in fact, do some kind of search of possible game trees. They don't go all the way to the end of the game. It's not clear whether a quantum computer could speed that up because they take advantage of certain things about chess. But there was a very recent result, you know, been in the press the past couple of weeks, about somebody finding the optimal sequence in the game of checkers. Right? So checkers, it turns out, is a draw if you play the optimal way. Both players are playing optimally. And to do this, they made a table of the end positions of checkers, and then they did an exhaustive search of the game tree up to that point. And it took an enormous amount of computing power and they did, you know, prove some theorems to show that they had narrowed it down enough. But it took an enormous amount of computing power to calculate this. If they had a quantum computer, that could have saved a lot of time. And, well, this is something that's still an area of active research. So maybe there's still other quantum algorithms out there that haven't been discovered but can do other interesting things like this. It is worth saying, though, that a quantum computer is not just a faster classical computer. There's some things it does much, much better, like factoring. But there's other problems where it doesn't help at all. So if you have a list of n things and you want to calculate whether there's an even or an odd number of them that you know, behave one way rather than another, a quantum computer is not going to help you with that. So this is, I think, important to emphasize. Normally, I mean, we're used to computers getting faster, right? And normally, every generation of computer that comes out is faster than the previous generation. But it's faster for everything. And it can run basically the same programs as the one before. It just does them faster. But a quantum computer doesn't run the same programs. It runs new kinds of programs. The ability to make these superpositions and to interfere things. And when you can take advantage of that, you can get a big speed up over a classical computer. When you can't take advantage of it, then you don't get anything. Okay? Any questions yet? Yeah. So the idea is a quantum computer, of course, would need special hardware. But there's no reason that you couldn't have your classical computer talking to the quantum computer. And, you know, it says, oh, here I have a problem that the quantum computer would be good at. It asks the quantum computer for the answer. Eventually, you know, the quantum computer does some calculation and comes back with the answer. Yeah, you could definitely do it. And in fact, when I talk, I guess it won't be obvious from what I'm saying, but I'll say a little bit more about how you build a quantum computer. And actually, in all of these examples, we're mostly thinking about the quantum computer being controlled by a classical computer anyway, because you know there's something that has to be manipulated in order to do all these quantum gates. And the classical computer is telling the quantum computer then what to do. Any other questions? OK. So let's talk about this factoring algorithm. And first, let's talk about RSA. So like I said, factoring is useful because you can break RSA with it. So RSA is really a very widely used encryption system. It's used if you go on the web, if you connect to Amazon, you have to give a credit card number to pay for the book. And you want to encrypt it so that somebody listening over the internet can't learn your credit card number. And this encryption is done using RSA. So if RSA turned out to be insecure, if people weren't able to build quantum computers, this would have a big impact because everyone has to change all the encryption system that they use. So how does RSA work? Well, there's two pieces of the RSA system. So one piece is an encryption key that's used to encrypt messages. So if Alice wants to send a message to Bob, Alice uses the encryption key to take her message and encode it in some way so that it's not going to be obvious to an eavesdropper what the message is. And then Bob has a decryption key that he uses to decrypt the message to get it back into its original form so he can read it. So the encryption key in this case is a pair of large numbers, N and E. So N is some big number, like 300 digits long, which is a product of two primes. And E is another number which is, you know, roughly the same size but smaller than N. And to encrypt a message, what Alice does is she, so first of all, you know, the message might be originally in words, but you know, using regular stuff you could do for the classical computer, you convert it to numbers, to a series of bit strings. And you break those numbers up into big chunks. And so the message is now going to be a series of numbers, each less than N. And you can encode any message this way, just given enough chunks. And for each of these numbers, what we're going to do is going to raise it to the power e, okay, exponentiate it, and then divide by n and take the remainder. So this business of dividing by n and taking the remainder is called modular arithmetic. So we say, so if we were encrypting x, we take x to the e, and then we have, for the encrypted message, we're going to have x to the e mod n. So what do we do with this? Well, So you have this encrypted message. You send it over some communications line to Bob. Alice sends it to Bob. And then Bob has a decryption key, D. And D has a special property that relates it to E. But in order to figure out what D should get matched with what E, you need to know the prime factors of N. So that's not a problem for Bob, because Bob can set things up so that, well, he created N by picking two large prime numbers and multiplying them together. And then he gave his public key to, and then he picked an E and gave the public key N and E to Alice. But going the other way is hard, right? If factoring is hard, then if somebody only knows the public encryption key N and E, they can't figure out what those prime factors are without, you know, doing one of these really huge computations. So only Bob is able to figure out what the proper D to use is. And then to decrypt a message, he'll take the thing he got from Alice and raise it to the power d, and then again divide by n and take the remainder. Okay, and d and e are chosen in just such a way they have this special relationship, so that when Bob does this, he gets back exactly the original message that Alice sent. You know, divided up into numbers less than n. Okay, and it's really believed that in order to break this RSA crypto system is just as hard as factoring the number n. You might, you know, try to go through some other route, but it's not going to get you any advantage. Okay? Everyone understand this, how this works? Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, then they can do exactly what Bob would do, and they can read every message that Bob gets sent. That's right. So this is what's called a public key system. So N and E, you can give them to everyone you know. You can post them on the internet. You can put them in a newspaper, whatever you want. But the decryption key D, as you point out, has to be kept very secret. So you only keep that yourself. The advantage is that you don't need it to send messages. You only need it to read messages. So really, only one person needs to know D. And you know, you give a key to someone else, you don't know what they're going to do with it. But the key you keep yourself, you can take care of it. Anything else? OK. So now where does a quantum computer come in? So a quantum computer, as I said, is very good at factoring large numbers. So let me give you a taste of how that works. So it turns out there's some classical number theory behind this. But it turns out that if you can find the period of a function, then you can have a particular function, which is a to the x. Well, I didn't write it, but it's modulo n again. So take some particular number a, always the same a, and raise it to different powers x. Okay, and that's easy to do, right? And then you divide by n and take the remainder. Well, since you're taking the remainder, the thing you get out at the end has to be less than n. And eventually, as you raise to more and more powers of x, you have to get back to where you started. Right? So that's called the period of this function. If you go, you know, f of 1, f of 2, f of 3, f of 4, eventually it starts repeating itself. Okay? And it turns out that if you can figure out what that period is, then you can factor the number n. Okay, and what a quantum computer is going to do is then figure out the period. So how does it do that? Well, to start with, we create a superposition. So we try all possible numbers x to start with. Okay? And we calculate f of x, a to the power x mod n, for all the terms in the superposition. Okay? So now what we're going to do is we're going to measure what value of a of x we got. A to the x we got. So we get something. Let's call it c. But c, remember, this is a quantum system. We had a superposition over all possible values of c. So when we make a measurement, we just get a random result, right? It could be any c. But we know there's more than one possible quantum state that could, more than one possible classical state that could give the answer c, right? Because this function is periodic. It repeats after some number of things are. So there's some value x0 that would have f of x0 equals c, and another value x0 plus r, and another value x0 plus 2r, and x0 plus 3r, and so on. Okay, and we don't know which of those we started with, because we only measured c. So what that means is that the remaining quantum state is still in a superposition over all possible values that are consistent with this answer c. And so we can draw this as a series of peaks at those possible values. And those peaks are separated by this distance r, so they're evenly spaced. Okay, now if we were just to measure this to see, well, what we'd like to know is the distance between two of these peaks. If we were to just measure, we'd get one peak at random. That doesn't tell us anything. Because remember, the starting position here was just random, right? It could be anything, because c is random. So we need to do something more clever. We need to do some interference. And to do that, we do something called the Fourier transform. Now, I don't know if you've heard of the Fourier transform before, but actually, you're doing it all the time. Your ear does it, or at least your brain, some combination of your brain and ear do it, when you listen to sounds. And you break the sound, remember, is a high and low pressure vibration in the air. And your ear takes those high and low pressure vibrations, and it figures out the frequencies. Right? That's why you can hear pitches in music. Those are separate frequencies. And to calculate those from the high and low pressure vibrations, your brain has to do a Fourier transform. So it turns out we can do a Fourier transform on these quantum superpositions. And doing that tells us what this period is. Right, because that's a frequency. That's the same thing as happening at evenly spaced intervals. Okay, and when we know that frequency, we know the period of this function, and we can use that to factor numbers, which in turn tells us how to break RSA. Okay. So this is an example. I didn't give all the details, of course, but this is an example of how you can use a quantum computer and interference to do something that's really hard on a classical computer, because well, as I said, factoring numbers is hard. You can see that finding the period would be hard because you'd have to try, you know, 1, 2, 3. You'd have to go all the way through until you got back to where you started with. And if the period is very large, that would obviously take a long time. But the quantum computer can do it pretty quickly. Okay. So I mentioned that I was going to say something about how we build quantum computers. So actually, there's lots and lots of ways that people are thinking of building quantum computers. We haven't gotten very far, but there are quantum computers in existence. They're just very, very small. And I don't mean because they're built of single atoms. I mean they're small in terms of number of qubits. So one example, one of the more advanced ones, is called an ion trap quantum computer. And the idea there is the qubits are stored in single atoms. So atoms, remember, have a cloud of electrons around them. And the outermost electron, let's say it has two possible states. It actually has much more, but for the purposes of a quantum computer, we're only really interested in two. And those two possible states are going to be the 0 and 1 of the qubit. And because the electron is so small, it behaves quantum mechanically, it can also be in a superposition of 0 and 1. Okay? And so this electron in each atom will serve as our quantum bit, our qubit. So these ions can be then, so these are charged atoms, actually. So we can trap them using a magnetic bottle and then manipulate them using lasers that will switch us from 0 to 1 and back and interact different atoms with each other. So as I said, this is one of the more advanced quantum computers, which means that they built quantum computers where they could control all the qubits, and there were 4 of them. So obviously, with 4 qubits, you're not going to be able to factor a very big number. But people are, you know, working on improving these things, and maybe someday we'll be able to. So, but like I said, there's lots of other ways we can build quantum computers. So another one is to use superconductors. So the idea here is you use superconducting wires and structures. And if you make them small enough, then the current carriers and superconductors can be in quantum superpositions. And so then you can build superconducting circuits just like you build regular circuits in a classical computer. And you know your qubits, well, there's a couple of possible ways to do it. It could be, so the current in a superconductor is carried by something called a Cooper pair. So it could be in the position of a Cooper pair. It's either here or here. It could be in magnetic flux in the circuit. That could be one way or the other. Or some more esoteric quantum quantities that are used in describing superconductors. But anyway, you basically build kind of regular-looking circuits and can control them using the regular things you do to control circuits, right? Voltages, inductances, things like that. So these are less advanced because it's really hard to build superconductors that are small enough. But even so, people have built 2-qubit quantum computers using superconductors. So another system is NMR. So NMR is the same technology that's used in MRI devices that can, you know, look to see inside bodies the positions of various organs, things like that. And what they do is each molecule, basically, in some sample, is a single quantum computer. And then the nuclear spin in these molecules, which could be, say, up or down, is your qubit. And so each atom is a single qubit. And these nuclear spins interact with each other because they're next to each other in the same molecule. And you use big magnetic fields and radio frequency to manipulate these things and control them, to flip them from, say, 0 to 1. And so this is a picture of an NMR machine in University of Wiley, which you may or may not see at some point Friday. This is a pretty mature technology, so they've actually gone up to 12 qubits, had a molecule that had 12 identifiable and controllable spins in it. Unfortunately, the method they're using to do that doesn't tend to scale very well, so that's kind of the limit of what NMR can do. But there's, well, it's kind of a limit of what NMR can do easily, I should say. And easily is already too strong a term. There are ideas for using NMR and other kinds of systems to go even further. But those are not as advanced as maybe some of these other things. And then there's lots and lots of other ideas. So for instance, you can basically store quantum information in anything that behaves quantum mechanically. The cache is being able to control it and being able to isolate it well enough so that it stays quantum for a long time. It stays in a superposition. But for instance, if you have a single particle of light, a photon, it has polarization, so it could be, say, left circularly polarized or right circularly polarized. That could be a qubit. We'll see an example of that in a minute. You could have atoms in an optical lattice crisscrossing lasers. They form little wells. The atoms like to sit in these wells. Again, you can use the electron levels in these atoms then as qubits. You can build use semiconductors like silicon and build microscopic structures like quantum dots, sometimes called artificial atoms, and use the energy level of electrons in these quantum dots or the spin of the electrons or something like that as a qubit. And there's lots more ideas, some even much more esoteric than these. And there are people working on all of these different ideas to try to realize them experimentally. Some are harder than others. None of them is easy. But you know, we're making steady progress. And maybe someday, using one of these ideas, or maybe even something that someone hasn't thought of yet, I think there's a good chance we'll have big quantum computers big enough to do some of these interesting things I was talking about with quantum algorithms. Okay? So there are questions about these implementation stuff? Yeah. Well, so we use the word qubit to kind of refer to either one. So it's kind of the abstract thing, which is the information. It's not really information. It's quantum information that's stored in these nuclear spins. But we also say the physical object that stores this is a qubit. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of connected to each other. But yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. So these individual nuclear spins, they can have lots of different possible states, right? Just like, you know, a book can have, you know, in it lots of different words, right? So it's... Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so in the different ways of building a quantum computer store the quantum information in different places, in different properties. And so the different types of implementations that I'm mentioning all have different kinds of qubits. Anything else? Yeah. Well, so that is going to differ a lot from one kind of quantum computer to another. So let's see. So let's talk about the ion trap. So in the ion trap, we have the two atoms. Say, let's just imagine we only have two. And what you have to do is you shine a laser on one of them. Okay? And what that does is it excites, so if you shine a laser of just the right frequency, if this atom is in the ground state, the zero state, nothing really happens to it. The frequency is off resonance, it doesn't do anything. But if it's in the excited state, then it starts an oscillation. So the kind of the momentum of the laser hits the atom, and it starts to move. And because the two atoms are charged, these are ions, remember, the other one also then starts to move. And so they move together. It depends, you know, it might be, say, this mode, where they move back and forth like this. And then you shine a laser on the second atom. And that laser is of such a particular frequency that what happens to this atom depends on whether or not it's moving. So remember, the first atom was in the ground state. This one is not moving. And so this laser then doesn't do anything. But if the first atom was in the excited state, then the atoms are moving. And shining the laser on this one will cause the electron to flip from one energy level to the other. So it'll go from ground to excited and from excited to ground. OK? And then you have to do another laser pulse to have them stop oscillating. But then you've done your controlled knot. The first one was ground. Second one doesn't do anything. The first one is excited. The second one is flipped. Okay? And it's different in all of these systems. And sometimes you have to work pretty hard because you know the controls you have don't necessarily do the controlled knot right away. And so you might have to do a couple of different things in order to get all the way to the specific quantum gate that you want. Yeah? Well, so the speed of a quantum computer is not really dependent on the number of qubits, just like the speed of a classical computer is not dependent on the number of bits in its memory. I guess you might be a little confused, because classically the speed can be dependent on memory. This is because if you have a lot of space to store things, you can do some things faster, you know, by calculating something and storing it, and then maybe you have to get back to it later. Whereas if you only have a little bit of extra memory, you have to recalculate it. You don't have space to store it. And that same thing would be true with a quantum computer. But mostly, the most important thing about the speed of a quantum computer is what kind of system it's in. So some of these systems are really very slow. The ion trap, I mean, these things are basically like millihertz. Sorry. So basically these ion traps can basically do a few thousand operations in a second, which is nothing compared to, you know, today's classical computers. But the advantage is that they can do this in superpositions. So you get a big speed up and a slowdown. And for the right kind of problem, the speed up is bigger than the slowdown. Other computers, like these superconducting ones, are very fast. I mean, because they're made of very small electronics, there is kind of, you know, as with classical computers, as you make the pieces smaller and smaller, they get faster and faster. So these superconductor computers, for each individual gate, would be maybe even faster than today's. Plus, you get the quantum speed up on top of that. So that's obviously a really good thing. Yeah. Yeah. Mostly they like, for this particular system of the ion trap, they like to use group 2 atoms that have, so group 2 atoms, I don't know if you remember your chemistry, but they have two electrons in their outer shell. Okay. And then if you take one of them away, it becomes positively charged. You have only one electron in the outer shell. And that's convenient because then you can use that one electron in, you know, the two possible states as your qubit. And so people have done things with a bunch of different group 2 atoms. It's not really clear which is the best one. Well, anyway, I don't know. The experimentalists, I'm sure, have definite opinions as to which are the better ones. Anything else? OK, so maybe then let's move on. So quantum computers, as I told you, if you had a really big quantum computer, you could factor large numbers, you could break RSA. So it seems like quantum computers are really bad for cryptography. They kill one of these, actually a lot of very widespread cryptographic systems. But it turns out that quantum computers are also good for cryptography. They help you make better codes. And so to do that, I have to tell you then a little bit more about classical cryptography. So it turns out that in classical cryptography, there's already an unbreakable code system. It's called the one-time pad. So how does that work? Well, again, you want to, for Alice to send the message to Bob, she wants to convert her her message into a number, a series of bits in this case. So 00001, 10011, et cetera. Okay. And this time, this is called the private key system. Alice and Bob have the same key used to encrypt the message and to decrypt the message. And the eavesdropper, Eve, is not supposed to have this key at all. And so this key is also a sequence of bits, but it's just random bits. 00101111, et cetera, as an example. Okay? And then to encrypt using the one-time pad, well, you basically do the controlled not. You say, well, if the key bit is 0, we'll leave the message bit alone. So like here, 0 becomes 0. And here, the message bit is 1, the key bit is 0, so we leave the encrypted message bit as a 1. But if the key bit is 1, then we flip the message bit. So for instance, 0 here becomes 1. Okay? And since the key bit was random, well, half the time the original message bit is flipped and half the time it's not. So if you don't know what the key bits are, you just see a random sequence of bits. But if you do know what they are, then you can just undo the procedure. The encoding procedure, right? You flip it back if the key bit is a 1. And then you get back the original message. So it's very easy to read if you have the key and impossible to read. And when I say impossible, I don't mean very hard. I mean actually impossible if you don't have the key. OK, so if this encryption system is so secure, why does anybody use anything else? Well, there's a big disadvantage, which is that the key here has to be a really long sequence of bits, right? You need one new random bit for every bit in the message you want to send. And what's more, there's a reason it's called the one-time pad. You're only allowed to use this key once. And if you don't use it once, then it's possible to break messages. And this has actually happened in history. The Soviet Union accidentally, during the Cold War, used the keys for one-time pad twice. And the National Security Agency in the US was able to find out about a number of Russian spies this way. But you know, nevertheless, despite having to have these really long keys and only being able to use them once, if you really want to be secure, this is the system you should use. And so people do use it for very important things, like you know, things where maybe it's really critical that the information doesn't leak out, like spying. But then there's a question of how you get this really long sequence of bits, this secret key, to someone else. Because if the eavesdropper knows this key, well, then she'll be able to read your message. And so you know, today what happens is a courier with a briefcase handcuffed to his arm goes to the airport, travels from Alice to Bob, and delivers the key. And in this briefcase that has all these extra security measures is nothing but random bits. And yet this is a really valuable commodity. Random bits for cryptographers are incredibly important. So the advantage of this is classical, purely classical. But the advantage of quantum computing is it can get rid of this courier. Instead of sending it with a physical courier who you know might be bribed or betray you somehow, you can send them using quantum bits. And the way that works is we take advantage of superpositions to create different possible states that can be sent and different possible measurements. So the idea here is Alice is gonna want to send random bits to Bob to set up this secret key that they can then use in the one-time pad. So the system is going to be called quantum key distribution, or QKD for short. And the idea here is Alice is going to send one of four possible states for each key bit that she wants to send. So we'll pair them up. So I mean, since we're sending these over, you know, from one place to another, maybe it's good to use photons as qubits, right? Because photons move very easily from one place to another. It's getting them to stay put that's hard. And so we're going to use, say, the polarization of photons. And so what we could do is we could, well, remember, photons have a polarization, which is the direction their electromagnetic fields oscillate. So for instance, it could be vertical polarization, right? They're shaking up and down like this. Okay, so we could call that a zero. Or it could be horizontal polarization, like this. And we could call that a one. Okay? And we'll call this pair of things the two Z states. And we'll write those as just a 0 and 1 for a qubit. But there's other possible states we could send. For instance, we could do the superposition states. If we did the Hadamard transform that I mentioned before, we could send 0 plus 1, which corresponds to a diagonal polarization, or 0 minus 1, which corresponds to a diagonal polarization the other way. Okay? And these are going to be 0 and the 1, the key bit values for the x states. Okay? So we have these four possible states, the two x states and the two z states. And each time, and Alice is going to send a whole bunch of these. She's going to send, for each key bit that she wants to send, she's going to choose one of these at random and send it to Bob. Well, what did Bob do then? Well, Bob has to figure out which one it is. And that's actually a problem. Suppose he thinks it's one of the z states. Well, then he can do a measurement to see, is it 0 or is it 1? And if it really was a Z state, he'll be right, assuming there's you know, nothing else going on. Okay, but suppose it was an X state instead. Remember, the X states in quantum language of quantum superpositions are 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1. And those should both be over root 2. Remember the normalization. But we can ignore that because we know it has to be there. So anyways, 0 plus 1, 0 minus 1. If you measure either of those to see if it's a 0 or 1, well, you get 0 or 1. You really do get one of those answers, but you get them randomly, right? So 0 plus 1 is equally likely to tell Bob that the bit was 0 or 1, when really it should have been 0, right? Because that was 0 plus 1 is the 0 in the x basis. And similarly, 0 minus 1, 50% chance of getting 0, 50% chance of getting 1. The problem is that what's going to happen is that when Bob receives these from Alice, he's going to guess. Is it an X or Z? He's going to make the appropriate measurement. If he's right, then he finds out the same bit as Alice sends. If he's wrong, he gets something random. But since these were just random bits, it's not a big deal if they throw out the ones where it didn't work. So after Bob makes his measurement, Alice and Bob will compare notes. Alice will say, I sent an X state. And Bob says, oh, I measured an X state. We'll keep that one. But if Alice says, I sent an X state, and Bob says, I measured a Z state, then they know that Bob doesn't have any idea what bit Alice sent. And so they'll throw that one out. Right, so if the random bits, it's not a big deal. Obviously, you don't want to do this with message bits. If you're sending your message, you don't want to throw out half the bits of it. But this is just random bits that we're going to use for the key. So that's OK then. OK, so what about the eavesdropper? So let's put the eavesdropper into the picture. So suppose there's somebody, Eve, who's listening in on this quantum channel. Say you send these photons over a fiber optic cable. And Eve wants to know whether it's a 0 or 1, the key bit. But Eve faces the same problem as Bob, right? She doesn't know whether it's an X state or a Z state. So if she guesses and guesses right, she'll learn what the key bit was. But if she guesses wrong, she's going to introduce errors. So how does that work? Well, suppose Alice sent the state 0, so one of the Z states. But Eve guesses incorrectly that it was one of the X states, and she makes that measurement. Well, then she guessed wrong, so she's going to get a random result. 50% chance of either possibility. Suppose you get 0 plus 1. That's the 0 in the X state. The problem is that when she sends that on to Bob, thinking that that was the actual state that Alice sent, suppose Bob measures correctly in the Z basis, right? He should be measuring Z because Z is what Alice sent. And suppose Bob happens to guess right, but he's receiving the wrong state. He's receiving 0 plus 1. And if he measures Z on that, he'll get 0 and 1 with equal probability. OK? So if he happens to get 0, well, then he doesn't know anything is wrong. If he gets 1 and Alice and Bob happen to compare notes, they'll see that there's an error there. And if there's a bunch of errors in the bits that Bob receives from Alice, they'll decide there's an eavesdropper and they can't use the key. OK, so let's put this all together. So here's how quantum key distribution works. Alice, remember, wants to set up this random bit string. So she creates a whole sequence of random bits and chooses for each one whether to send it an X or a Z state. OK, and she makes the corresponding qubits and sends them to Bob, say, over an optical fiber. And then Bob is going to choose for each one X or Z at random. He's going to make the appropriate measurement. And then Alice and Bob are going to compare their X and Z values, as I said before. If they get the same thing, they keep them. If they get different things, they throw them away. Now, it's really important that they're only comparing whether it's X or Z. They're not comparing whether they got 0 or 1. Right? Because if they announced what all of their bits were that Alice sent or that Bob measured, then the eavesdropper would just listen to that. She wouldn't have to do anything to the qubits. And she'd learn the key that way. So they only announce whether it's X or Z. But they do still want to see what the error rate is. So they pick some of the bits to use up. They're not going to use them as part of the final key. They instead use them to test the error rate. And Alice announces what she sent for those, and Bob announces what he got. And they compare to see if they're the same. If they're different, then that's an error, right? And they count up the number of errors in this test sample. And that tells them, roughly speaking, how much error there is in the overall system. If the error rate is low, well, they don't know it's an eavesdropper, right? Nothing's perfect. The fiber optic cable might have some flaws. The detectors they're using might have some flaws, et cetera. And so they still want to use it if the error rate is low. If the error rate is high, well, then it could be an eavesdropper. The eavesdropper, in that case, would have gotten a lot of information. And so they know that it's not safe to use the key. So they throw it out. And then maybe they try again later to establish a new key. But if everything is OK, if the error rate is low, well, they have to get rid of those remaining errors. So they use an error correcting code to do that. And well, it could be that Eve has a little bit of information, right? So it could have been an eavesdropper listening to them. And she might know a few bits of the message. And so they have to kind of mix things up a bit using something called privacy amplification to squeeze out Eve's information. And once they've done this, Eve really has very little information at all, exponentially small amount. And the upshot is that either Eve does something big, in which case Alice and Bob can detect her with very high probability, or Eve doesn't really do much eavesdropping at all, in which case she gets very little information about the final key. OK? And then once they have the secret key, they can use it, as I said, in the one-time pad or some other cryptographic system. Yeah? Right. So the idea is they're sending two kinds of messages here. So sometimes Alice is sending quantum messages to Bob, sending qubits, single photons in the superposition. But sometimes Alice and Bob are just talking, you know, over the phone with the regular classical messages. So they use these classical messages to say whether they're using X or Z. Of course, Eve, the eavesdropper, can listen in on those on the phone conversations because those are not encrypted. So that's why it's important that they don't say over the phone anything that they're going to use in the final secret key. But saying whether it's an X or Z, that's okay. No, each time it's a different one, chosen at random. Okay? Anything else? Okay. So so if you might notice that the first thing I talked about, quantum computers, use one set of ways of making it, one set of qubits. Whereas the second thing I talked about, quantum cryptography, used photons as qubits, which weren't so great for building quantum computers. Now, why is that? Well, the needs of the two systems are different, right? In a quantum computer, you want to store qubits for a long time. You want to be able to have them talk to each other. In quantum cryptography, you want to move qubits from one place to another. So photons are very good at moving from one place to another, but they're hard to store. They're hard to get to talk to each other. Whereas atoms, well, it's not easy to get them to talk to each other in a quantum way, but it's much easier than getting photons to talk to each other. So atoms are relatively good as qubits, but it's much harder to move them around. Right? You can't send them through an optical fiber. You could maybe move them, but that's slow. So what you'd really like is some way of combining these two properties so that you could do operations when you wanted, and you could move qubits around when you wanted. And so one way of doing that is the idea of quantum teleportation. So quantum teleportation, what it does is it basically splits up. So basically, you do things with a quantum computer, but it splits up the task of moving qubits around, which is kind of hard, into two pieces. So it's quantum communication is your goal, and you have a quantum piece and kind of a communication piece. The quantum piece, Alice wants to send a qubit to Bob, so they create some special quantum state, an entangled state. And I guess John Walgate told you a bit about entangled states earlier. And then using that entangled state, they make some measurements, send some classical information. That's the communication part. Again, they can just do that, you know, for a regular phone line. And putting these two things together, the classical information that Bob has and his part of the quantum state, he can reconstruct the quantum state that Alice sent. So how does that work? So So what kind of entangled state do they use? Well, to do that, we have to think about measurements again. So remember, we had these X measurements and these Z measurements that I talked about for the quantum cryptography part. So Bob could make either the X measurement or the Z measurement, but he can't make both at once. Right? The Heisenberg uncertainty principle, for instance, prevents you from learning everything you can about the quantum state. And we saw how that worked in the case of quantum cryptography. Right? If you make the X measurement, well, it disturbs the state if it was actually a Z state to start with. But it turns out that if you make what's called a parity measurement on two qubits, so if you want to make the X measurement on two qubits, but you don't care about the individual answers, you only care whether those answers are the same or different. That's called a parity measurement. And that measurement is compatible with the Z parity measurement. If you make a Z on both qubits, you don't care about the individual answers, but only whether they're the same or different. So this X parity and the Z parity, you can make both of those on two qubits at once. And so the particular entangled state we want, we'll call it an EPR pair, has this property that if you make the X parity measurement, you always get the same answer for both qubits. And if you make the Z parity measurement, you also always get the same answer. There's no randomness involved in these two measurements. If you just measure X for one qubit, then you'll get a random result for this entangled state. And if you just measure Z for one qubit, you'll always get a random result. But if you make the same measurement on the other qubit, you'll get the same random result. OK? So this is an entangled state. using entangled states like this, you can do the kind of weird stuff that John told you about. And in particular, one of the things you can use it to do quantum teleportation. So now we're going to take this EPR pair, and we're going to give one qubit of this EPR pair to Alice, and one qubit of the EPR pair to Bob. And then Alice has another qubit that she wants to send to Bob. So what she's going to do is she's going to make the X parity measurement between her EPR qubit and the qubit she wants to send, and also, because it's compatible, the Z parity measurement. Right? So she's saying, are these the same or different for X measurements and for Z measurements? And she gets two answers there, right? Each one can be yes or no. Are they the same or different? So it's two bits. She sends those bits. These are classical bits, remember, because she's getting a definite answer. She sends these classical bits to Bob. And then Bob is going to do something to reconstruct Alice's original quantum state. So what does he do? Well, here's what Bob thinks. He says, well, OK, suppose for the X parity measurement, Alice tells me that her qubit and the EPR qubit were the same. Well, I know that her half of the EPR qubit and my half of the EPR qubit, those are also the same for the X parity measurement, right? Because that's the property of this EPR pair. So if her qubit is the same as her EPR qubit, and her EPR qubit is the same as my EPR qubit, then her qubit must be the same as my EPR qubit. Her qubit that she wants to send must be the same as my EPR qubit, right? And similarly, if her qubit was different from her EPR qubit, and her EPR qubit is the same as my EPR qubit, because, again, that's the property of the EPR pair, then the qubit that she wants to send must be different from my EPR qubit. So what he can do is he can flip it. Go from one of the X states to the other X states. You do the same thing for the Z parity. And again, flip it if it's different. Okay? And so putting these two pieces together, it turns out that in the end, Bob's qubit will always be the same as the one that Alice sent. So there's a couple of things worth noticing here. So first of all, Alice had to make a measurement. And when she makes this measurement, she destroys the original qubit. So the qubit that she wanted to send is gone from her side, and Bob has to reconstruct it. Okay? The other thing is that this EPR pair gets used up. So in order to do quantum teleportation, for lots and lots of qubits, you have to have lots and lots of EPR pairs. Because every time you do it, every time you send one qubit, you use up an EPR pair. You also need to send lots and lots of bits. And the result of this is that this is very good for moving quantum information around, but it's not so good for moving really big objects. So for instance, doing a little back of the envelope calculation, I figured out that there's about 10 to the 27 atoms in a person. And let's say that each atom has only two possible states, which is, of course, vastly underestimate. There's lots and lots more possible states than that. But that would mean that to teleport, use quantum teleportation to send a person from one place to another, would mean we have to teleport 10 to the 27 qubits. Okay? And each qubit we send, we have to send two classical bits of information. Right? So that's 2 times 10 to the 27 classical bits. And if you do some division over a 1 gigabit per second line, that would take 60 billion years. Okay? So you can see this is not going to happen anytime soon. So quantum teleportation is not like Star Trek teleportation. It's not for moving people or other big objects around. What it is good for is moving quantum information around. Okay? It's also true that if you have a big object, like a chair, you don't really need to know probably the exact quantum state of every single atom in the chair. It's just enough to know kind of what the chair looks like. Right? And then you can, and what it's made of, and then you can build it again on the other side, if you had sufficiently sophisticated technology to do that. But moving qubits around is really useful for a quantum computer, because if you have a big quantum computer, you might want to interact qubits over here with qubits in the other side of the quantum computer. And it's useful to have quantum teleportation to move things from here to here. Or maybe you could use it to create a quantum internet, where people in quantum computers in different locations could share quantum states with each other. And to do that, they only have to create these entangled states. That's not so easy, but it's easier than sending the qubits in the first place. Because the entangled state doesn't depend on which qubits you want to send. So for instance, you could create them ahead of time and spend a lot of time distributing them and checking that they're right and stuff like that. And so there's a pretty good chance that someday we'll, when we have these quantum computers, we'll also be doing quantum teleportation. But again, only at the level of individual qubits. Okay, so let me just sum up. So I've told you about some of the various properties of quantum information and some of the practical applications of these things. But it's worth emphasizing that there's theoretical side of this too. Well, first of all, there's the theoretical side of what can we do? How do we build these quantum computers? But by working with quantum computers and quantum information and thinking about what they might be able to do, we learn more about the behavior of quantum mechanics. So even if we never build a quantum computer, we'll still have that, right? We'll know, we'll have a better understanding of quantum mechanics. And that can help us understand other kinds of physics, because you know, a lot of physics uses quantum mechanics. It's also true, in fact, that thinking about quantum information can sometimes help us understand classical information better. And there are some cases where, using quantum information, people were able to prove new things about what you can do with classical information. Of course, you could have proved them without ever saying the word quantum. But thinking about quantum computers gave the inspiration to see how to solve these problems. So there's lots of other things you can do with quantum states. One thing that I work on is quantum error correction. Of course, you can imagine as you try to build these quantum computers, you made that in very small pieces, they're not going to work exactly right. So how do you build a quantum computer that still works overall to give you the right answer, even though the individual pieces of it are not working the way they're supposed to? Well, first of all, they have to be pretty close to what they're supposed to. But then you can do something called quantum error correction, which is more difficult than correcting classical information, but uses some of the same ideas. And it is, in fact, possible to build a reliable quantum computer out of noisy pieces. And then you know, there's other things, for instance, quantum communication complexity. Alice wants to talk to Bob. They want to solve some problem together. They might have to talk a lot back and forth to do this. They use qubits. In some cases, they can use less communication to solve the problem. And all sorts of other stuff. And as I said, this is still an active area of research, so some of the things that fall into this last heading, we don't even know about yet. People are still discovering those as we speak. And perhaps in the future, when maybe some of you are researchers in quantum information. But thanks. Yeah, so parity is a property just of regular classical bits, where if you have two bits, you want to say if they're the same or different. You can take the parity of more bits, actually, and then it's whether it's even or an odd number of ones. So for the case of the teleportation, I was thinking about two different kinds of parities. So the parity is, so if you make an x measurement on each of these two qubits, you get the same answer or a different answer. You don't actually make the individual x measurements. You only care about the parity, whether they're the same or different. Well, there's something called a quantum Turing machine. So it turns out that if you're only interested in computability, what can be computed, what cannot, that a quantum computer is no better than a classical computer. The reason for this is that, well, this quantum computer has this big superposition. And in principle, you could keep track of every term in the superposition and calculate, you know, what happens to this quantum wave function as it goes through the various steps of a quantum computer. So anything you could calculate on a quantum computer, you can do on a classical computer. The problem is it would be much, much slower. So if you only care whether it's possible or not, that's the same. If you care how fast it is, then you need to know. Is that a sufficient answer? Sure. So a quantum Turing machine. So a classical Turing machine is described as you have a long tape, which has you know, a string of symbols on it. And there's a head on the tape that moves around. And it changes the symbols on the tape. And the way it moves depends on also on what the symbols are. So a quantum Turing machine is kind of basically the same, except Now, the symbols on the tape are quantum states that can be in superposition. And the head can be in a superposition of different positions. Okay, and so you can have any kind of rule that's kind of compatible with that, with the laws of quantum mechanics that allows that.